I'm now going to give a brief summation of what is going to be included in Radio Free America 36th, the sixth and final installment. That title, once again, or the title of Radio Free America 36, is The Destabilization of the USSR in Eastern Europe, a Prelude to World War III? Question mark. And what I'm going to begin with is a brief synopsis of what we have looked at so far in this series by way of review. I'm going to review the central points of the first five installments. Then we're going to delve back into a very, very important issue of Covert Action Information Bulletin, specifically Covert Action Information Bulletin issue number 35. And I'm going to read a section of one more article and all of another by way of concluding and summing up and examining one of the main reasons why the current activities of the U.S. intelligence apparatus and the far right in this country, of course those two things are inextricably linked, why exactly these events and goings-on are so very, very dangerous, or one of the reasons why they're so very, very dangerous. We're going to begin by taking a look at a section of an essay by a fellow called Melvin Beck, last name B-E-C-K, and he is an expert or a student of the U.S. intelligence system and counterintelligence in particular. There's an essay in CAIB number 35 called The Loosening of Political Barriers, and he points out quite correctly, in my opinion, that both the Pentagon and the CIA essentially have a stock in maintaining the Cold War, that the huge budgets, the defense budgets that the Pentagon has enjoyed over the years are going to be reduced if, in fact, the Soviet menace, quote-unquote, is no longer perceived as such, that there is an attempt to destabilize the USSR and to provoke a reintroduction of Stalinism, a restarting of the Cold War has been one of the central themes of this program, and Melvin Beck obviously tends to agree with at least some aspects of that. We are also going to look at a long essay called The Balance of Terror. This is authored by a fellow, not too long an essay, but all of an essay by a fellow who calls himself Boris Badinoff, B-A-D-I-N-O-F. That's a pseudonym for a journalist and researcher who is watching the developments in Eastern Europe. He has an essay called Balance of Terror, and this Balance of Terror essay is one of the things that I think will represent one of the central points in this conclusion of Radio Free America 36. He basically points out that if there is a significant imbalance in the balance of terror that has existed between the U.S. and the USSR, and beyond that, if one side, in this case the USSR, feels that there is a serious, serious compromising and weakening of its intelligence system, that in and of itself would make a nuclear war more probable, not less probable. I'm in agreement with that, and we will be presenting that this evening for your examination. We will conclude both the prepared portion of tonight's broadcast and this last installment of Radio Free America number 36 with a couple of articles from the press this past week. Both of these, as a matter of fact, from today's San Francisco Sunday Examiner and Chronicle. Today, by the way, being Sunday, April 7th, 1991, for those of you who eventually hear this by tape or on tape. We are first going to be taking a look at the proposition currently being weighed in the United States to begin sharing technology with the Soviet Union concerning the remote disabling of nuclear weapons should those weapons fall into the hands of dissident nationalists within the USSR. There has been a proposition floated to share remote disabling technology with the Soviet Union in order to prevent the possibility of nationalist or terrorist groups within the USSR getting their hands on nuclear weapons. Many nuclear weapons have been removed from some of the most unstable republics in the Soviet Union. I wonder whether perhaps this is one of the carrots being floated along with a stick of the continued destabilization of the USSR and the reintroduction of fascist elements into the USSR and Eastern Europe that we've looked at over the past several weeks. We will talk about that, and we're going to take a look at an old and ominous name who has been discussing this, a fellow by the name of Sven Kramer, National Security Council member and the son of Fritz Kramer, the former plans officer for the U.S. Army for over 20 years, and also, almost certainly, formerly the chief of staff of the 6th SS Panzer Army for Hitler's Germany. We will conclude with a look at some comments by Dirty Dick Nixon. The evil one himself is back, and he has been in the USSR, and he basically discounts the Soviet Union as a world power. He says that basically their economy is so bad that even their military power no longer is relevant, and that their economy is so bad that they will not be able to keep up with military developments here in the United States. That will be by way of taking a look at what has happened in the past and what we can expect in the future. Dick Nixon himself, an individual who has a very sordid past, and unfortunately an individual who has been politically rehabilitated in spite of the fact that his connections range all the way from some of the Galen and Third Reich veterans that we've looked at for so many years on this program, all the way up through and including the assassination of President Kennedy. The JFK assassination was one of the things which lay at the heart of Watergate, even though tragically the mainstream press and even most of the so-called alternative press have chosen to ignore those very, very important connections. That is what we have on tap, and after a very short musical break, we will come back with the main body of tonight's final installment of Radio Free America program number 36, The Destabilization of the USSR in Eastern Europe, a prelude to World War III. It's time now to begin the actual main body of the final installment of Radio Free America program number 36. This is the sixth installment of the destabilization of the USSR in Eastern Europe, a prelude to World War III. And I'm going to highlight very briefly the major points that we have looked at so far by way of not only reviewing for the benefit of those of you who have missed programs, but also by way of tying together the many points of information in this broadcast, because this is a program, as I mentioned, that has been carried on over now, including tonight's broadcast, a six-week period. In the first installment, we began taking a look at one of the major underlying theses of the hypothesis that I'm looking at in this program, namely that the destabilization of the USSR has involved, among other things, what is in essence a flanking maneuver both on the southern and northern flanks of the Soviet Union. It is my opinion that the Gulf War, among other things, and it should be remembered in this regard, that when the U.S. National Security Establishment decides to move on any given issue, they do so when to move in that direction will scratch a number of different strategic itches at different levels simultaneously. Now, digressing briefly to review vis-a-vis the Gulf War has accomplished a number of different things that the National Security Establishment and the American far right have wanted. Domestically, of course, it has dramatically boosted the fortunes of George Bush. Domestically, it has also forestalled massive cuts in the defense budget, which had been forecast as a result of the, quote, end, unquote, of the Cold War. It has also served domestically to boost the profits of oil companies to a considerable extent. Domestically, it has also obscured a lot of very, very troubling economic issues, ranging from the gutting of the Bill of Rights, very disturbing legislation and judicial decisions that have been handed down, to the very precarious economic situation that the United States is in at the moment. Internationally, it has accomplished a number of different things. For one thing, a very clear message has been sent to any third world country that might attempt to challenge the military might of the United States. According to a United Nations report, Iraq has been bombed back to the pre-industrial stage, literally bombed back to the Stone Age, as the cliche has it. That undoubtedly has to serve as a blunt warning to any nation that would choose to challenge the United States militarily in the future, particularly a third world country that might attempt to resist the will not only of the United States, but by extension that of the multinational corporations as well. It is my opinion that one of the most important aspects of the Gulf War, and this is the aspect which ties in with the thesis, the hypothesis that I've been developing here over the last 6 weeks, that the Gulf War also represents in essence, a flanking maneuver against the Soviet Union on its southern flank, and consequently, a means of exerting tremendous pressure on the USSR. Now, reviewing very briefly, one of the most basic, or arguably the most basic, military maneuver in military strategic considerations is what is known as a flanking maneuver. A flanking maneuver was used by General Schwarzkopf to defeat the Iraqis. What it involves, basically, is projecting one's forces around the flank of your enemy's line of defense. This permits your forces to do a couple of things. First of all, to attack the enemy from his rear and cut off his lines of supply. That obviously will affect victory relatively quickly. Or if the enemy turns his forces around in order to meet the threat from the rear, that weakens his central line of defense, thus permitting a frontal assault to stand a much greater chance of breakthrough and success than it otherwise would. Flanking maneuver, because of its great effectiveness and the tremendous threat that it presents to a line of defense, is something which any military defense strategist will seek to avoid at any cost. The Gulf War involved the projection of enormous U.S. military power, including a lot of very sophisticated high-tech weaponry, onto the Soviet Union's southern flank. That took place at a very narrow distance from the Soviet Union. Also, Iraq utilized a lot of Soviet weaponry, although much of it was several generations out of date. Some of it was up to date. And beyond that, it should also be noted that the Iraqis also utilized some aspects of Soviet defensive strategy, although their military is not viewed as being up to a par with that of the Soviet Union. All of that notwithstanding, one of the things that we looked at in the first section, first installment of Radio Free America 36 6 weeks ago, was the fact that the relative success, in particular, of U.S. air power and some of the U.S. Air fleet's high-tech weaponry has been viewed with considerable alarm by the Soviet high command, and this has led them to not only reevaluate their own air defenses, but beyond that, it has created considerable anxiety in the Soviet Union and in the Soviet military high command about the projected cuts in Soviet military spending. The fear is that this would place them at a disadvantage at some point in the not-too-distant future vis-a-vis the United States. Obviously, the Soviet economy is in very, very bad shape. Continued high levels of military spending will make that very bad, weakened economy even worse, and consequently, that will cause the social unrest currently ravaging the Soviet Union to increase, and that, of course, will have a destabilizing effect on the USSR. We also took a look at the independence and nationalist movement in Lithuania, which is explicitly fascist in character. In a very important article from Covert Action Information Bulletin number 35, which we will be going back into once again this evening, we took a look at the Sąjūdis movement in Lithuania, that is the nationalist movement in Lithuania, and we reviewed some very important, though little-known, aspects of Lithuanian history. Lithuania, after it became independent from the Soviet Union, Lithuania had been part of the Russian Empire since the 18th century. After the Bolshevik Revolution in 1917, it became independent, and in the 1920s, it became the second fascist state in Europe. As an independent country, it was specifically modeled after the corporate state set up by Mussolini in Italy in the early 1920s. And we took a look at the links between President Landsbergis, historical and cultural links between President Landsbergis of Lithuania and Lithuania's fascist past. The fascist militia, which were operant in Lithuania and represented the basic security forces of fascist independent Lithuania, were called the Savandoriai or Svandoriai. I don't know how it's pronounced. Savandoriai. President Landsbergis' father was a member of the Savandoriai, and upon assuming the presidency of Lithuania, he not only revived the Savandoriai in defiance of Soviet law, but brought back both the flag and national anthem of independent and fascist Lithuania. Beyond that, we took a look at how the Savandoriai and independent, quote-unquote, Lithuania actively collaborated with the Third Reich, including the final solution, the Holocaust, the liquidation of Lithuanian Jewry, when the Third Reich invaded the Soviet Union in 1941. We then took a look at how three intersecting organizations, first of all, the National Endowment for Democracy, and then the two organizations used by that, have helped to reproject fascism into Lithuania. Landsbergis has received active assistance in basically restoring fascist elements to Lithuania and attempting to break Lithuania away from the USSR from not only the National Endowment for Democracy, but specifically the two main organs of NED activity inside Lithuania. Those organizations are the Lithuanian Catholic Religious Aid, or LCRA, and the very closely linked LIC, or Lithuanian Information Center. Those organizations were founded by a fellow named Archbishop Burgess, and I think that's how his name is pronounced, B-R-I-Z-Y-G-Y-S, or B-R-I-Z-G-Y-S. Let me double-check the spelling on that. I'm operating off the top of my head here. However, since I have the covert action information bulletin in front of me. I might as well get that and actually verify the spelling. It's B-R-I-Z-G-Y-S, okay, only one Y. B-R-I-Z-G-Y-S. I'm going to pronounce that Burgess, but that may be wrong. In any event, Archbishop Burgess had a history of collaboration with the Third Reich during the Nazi occupation of the USSR. He denies that, but there is abundant documentation for that. We went into that in this first installment of Radio Free America Program 36. And through the activities of LCRA and LIC, again, founded by a fellow who actively collaborated with the Third Reich and whose history of involvement with Lithuanian fascism is basically a matter of public record. At least we took a look at that part of the public record which is available in this particular article. It is to be noted that the return of fascist symbols and fascist elements to Lithuania should come as no great surprise, given the fascist antecedents of LCRA, LIC, and given their activities on behalf of the National Endowment for Democracy inside Lithuania. It should come as no surprise whatsoever that those kinds of elements and those kinds of symbols should reemerge in Lithuania. Now, as I mentioned, in one of the central points of the first section of Radio Free America 36 is that the Baltic states, which were ceded to the Soviet Union as a result of the Hitler-Stalin Pact in 1941, something the U.S. has never recognized, the Baltic states represent an absolutely critical area strategically for the Soviet Union. They give the Soviet Union their only warm water ports outside of the Kamchatka Peninsula and Vladivostok. Vladivostok is not ice-free all year round. Beyond that, the elimination of the Baltic states as a Soviet defense area would permit NATO naval forces, and the United States in particular, to operate with relative impunity right off the Soviet Union in the Baltic Sea. This obviously would badly compromise the Soviet Union from the standpoint of military strategy, and consequently it is something that I don't think the Soviet high command is likely to stand for. I do not think it is at all accidental that we saw a fierce crackdown by the Soviet military in Lithuania and the other Baltic states during the period immediately preceding the Gulf War. The Soviet military and the National Security Establishment, meaning the KGB and GRU, Soviet Military Intelligence, have made it very clear that they're not going to tolerate the breakup, the physical dissolution of the Soviet Union into its constituent republics. The proposed Lithuanian and Baltic independence movements are something, therefore, which can be expected to serve as provocation for the Soviet military, and ultimately, I suspect, if the independence programs continue, we may very well see an overt Soviet military coup and military occupation of these areas. Certainly the reintroduction of fascist elements such as the Savandorii, the fascist flag and national anthem, the activities of LCRA, LIC, founded by people like Archbishop Burgess with his history of involvement with fascism. This is something that I don't think the Soviet National Security Establishment is likely to stand for. I suspect that the United States itself is doing this in order to provoke, at least at one level, to provoke a Soviet response, which in turn would serve to heat up the Cold War. We could then, or our national security establishment could then point to the fact or the contention that we can't trust the Russians, therefore we've got to maintain the high levels of military spending that we have had over the many, many years. Obviously, if the Soviets themselves are forced to match that military spending, that is going to have a further destabilizing effect on the Soviets' economy. Now, another major section, another major element in the first installment is the fact that the Warsaw Pact, in the first downloading of information, the Warsaw Pact is in the process of dissolving. It has formally announced its dissolution. NATO, on the other hand, as a result of the Gulf War and also as a result of the Lithuanian crackdown and fears that that may signal a return to the Cold War, has received new vitality, and there is new talk not only of sustaining NATO, but perhaps even of including some of the former Soviet satellite states in an association with NATO. That also figures to greatly provoke the Soviet National Security Establishment, make them feel even that much more secure, and heighten, in my opinion, the possibilities of a military crackdown in the USSR, with the resultant resurgence or rejuvenation of the Cold War, which I fear may stem from these kinds of activities. Those were the central elements of the first installment of the broadcast. Now, in the second installment, we took a look at how the U.S. military spending, which took place under Ronald Reagan in the 1980s, was not so much to permit the United States to fight a nuclear war successfully, but rather this represented an element of destabilization against the Soviet Union. It was, in the opinion of Pershing Gervais, I believe his name was. Again, I will verify that from the covert action information bulletin that I have before me. Pershing Gervais is another observer, but Sean Gervais, in an article called A Full Court Press, The Destabilization of the Soviet Union, theorized, and I am in agreement, that the military buildup that took place in the United States under Ronald Reagan was not intended so much to actually give the United States the ability to successfully fight a nuclear war, as it was intended to destabilize the Soviet Union by forcing continued high levels of Soviet military spending, also denying them key technology, destabilizing them through the use of proxy wars, and this was intended to force changes in the Soviet political system by weakening Soviet society. This was made quite explicit by people like Richard Pipes, a key National Security Council advisor during the Reagan years, and he said in so many words, and Sean Gervais reports, fortunately, that the real goal was to force political changes in the Soviet Union to force them away from socialism and into a free market economy by basically placing an insuperable economic burden on the Soviet Union by forcing them to match our extraordinary military expenditures. Yeah, no, two other central elements of the second installment were my contention that the new push for Star Wars, which has taken place as a result of the success of the Patriot missiles against the Scud missiles, even though it's a very different technology, that this is not only something which had been predetermined by the Bush administration, but that this also is intended as an attempt to destabilize the Soviet Union further by forcing further high levels of Soviet military spending. And it is my belief that this had been intended for quite some time, and that also as a result of the Gulf War, the rejuvenation of Star Wars, the obvious destabilizing effect that's likely to have on the Soviet Union by forcing them to match our military buildup, I suspect this also was predetermined. Obviously, we can't say that for sure. It is, as I like to say, food for thought and grounds for further research. I suspect, though, that the rejuvenated Star Wars push, which George Bush introduced during the course of the Gulf War as a result of the success of the Patriot missiles, I suspect that had been predetermined for some time. I also made the point in the second installment that there is very firm evidence that the United States actually provoked Saddam, I'm falling into that trap myself, Saddam Hussein into invading Kuwait. The two main points of information from a very important article in the London Observer from October 21st of 1990 are a study commissioned for Iraq and the other Arab oil-producing states by the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C., which strongly advised the Arab nations to push for a $25 a barrel price, saying that the West and the United States consumers in particular would stand for a $25 a barrel price for oil, and recommended that a Gulf state with the military power to do so put pressures on its neighbors to go along with the $25 a barrel price. And beyond that, there were very clear diplomatic signals sent to Saddam Hussein that the U.S. would do nothing if the Iraqis invaded Kuwait, and there were very firm indications all along, or for quite some time, I should say, that they were going to do just that. The most important and most publicized of these diplomatic signals was a conference that U.S. Ambassador to Iraq April Glaspie had with Saddam Hussein, in which she indicated that Arab border disputes were no concern of the United States. As I said, it is my belief, and one of the central contentions of the hypothesis that I have been developing over the past several weeks, that though this war had been planned for quite some time, and as I indicated a couple of minutes ago, it satisfied a number of different considerations at different levels, and I suspect the Pentagon had in mind many of the things that it has gained from the Gulf War for quite some time. Certainly the image of the Pentagon and the U.S. military has undergone an enormous boost in prestige as a result of the war. In the third installment, the third week, we took a look at the second kind of pressure to be placed on the Soviet Union as a result of the, or as a component of the binary destabilization, which Sean Gervasi, in his article of Full Court Press, the destabilization of the Soviet Union, presented in the article we covered in week two. Now, in that article, Gervasi said that destabilization involves external pressure, and he spoke about the Full Court Press and the military buildup of the Reagan administration as one of the elements putting pressure on the Soviet Union. He also said that, in addition, the destabilizing or attacking power also has to interfere in the domestic politics of the victim nation or the defending nation in order to rearrange its politics according to its own liking. The major vehicle for political intervention in the Soviet Union has been something that we looked at in week three, an institution called the Free Congress Foundation, or FCF. This is an organization founded by Paul Weyrich, W-E-Y-R-I-C-H, one of the linchpins of the American far right, and an individual who, not incidentally, was very much involved with helping to engineer the political success of Ronald Reagan and the American far right in this country for quite some time. It's worth noting that there are very strong connections between the Free Congress Foundation and Boris Yeltsin, Mikhail Gorbachev's main political opponent in the Soviet Union. It's also worth noting that the Free Congress Foundation has very strong connections to some organizations with fascist past and the explicit Nazi involvement. Specifically, we have reviewed connections between Charles Moser, a key FCF official, and the OUN, a Ukrainian fascist and nationalist organization which collaborated first with Nazi Germany and then jumped to the United States along with the spy organization of Reinhard Gehlen. Recalling briefly, of course, the Gehlen organization is one of the things that we have looked at for many years here on this broadcast. Reinhard Gehlen, last name G-E-H-L-E-N, was Hitler's chief of intelligence for the Eastern Front during World War II. He headed up an organization called FHO, or Fremde Heere Ost. That was the Nazi Eastern Front intelligence organization during the Second World War. After the war, he jumped to the CIA with his entire organization and became, in effect, the CIA's Department of Russian and Eastern European Affairs. It then became, in turn, the de facto NATO intelligence organization, and finally the BND, the Bundesnachrichtendienst, the West German Intelligence Service, now, of course, the German Intelligence Service, since there is no longer an East and West Germany. It should be noted that in addition to the operational and institutional ties between elements and people associated with FCF, such as Charles Moser and the OUN, also very closely involved with the Anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations, or ABN, a fascist organization which began in association with Adolf Hitler in 1943, and which also has been a key element not only of the World Anti-Communist League, the former World Anti-Communist League, but also of the Gehlen spy organization. One of the people who was tabbed by FCF to head up FCF political activity in Eastern Europe was a fellow named Laszlo Pastor, last name P-A-S-Z-T-O-R, of the Anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations. Pastor was a former member of the Arrow Cross fascist organization in Hungary. That organization collaborated actively with Hitler, as did Hungary during the Second World War. And Pastor, very close to ABN also, the Anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations, is a key Free Congress Foundation functionary inside the Soviet Union, and he also has been very active in Hungary as well. Another point that we looked at in the third installment was the attack by Boris Yeltsin, a vicious attack by Yeltsin on Mikhail Gorbachev the day after Gorbachev proposed his unsuccessful peace initiative for Iraq, thereby, in my opinion and that of several other observers, attempting to forestall the what was in essence the U.S. flanking maneuver on the Soviet Union's southern flank. I do not think that the timing of Yeltsin's attack, given his association with people like the Paul Weyrich-founded FCF with its many fascist elements and involvement, the attack by Yeltsin on Gorbachev at that time, I suspect, was no accident. Can't prove it, of course, but it falls into the category of food for thought and grounds for further research, one of the main operating concepts of this broadcast over the years. In the fourth installment, we reviewed from our archives the history of the attempts by the United States and the West in general to destabilize the Soviet Union, and specifically attempts to fragment the Soviet Union and break it up into its constituent nationalities. We took a look at information from Radio Free America, number one, reviewing the OUN, the Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists, its association with the Third Reich, and its jump to the CIA. The OUN has long advocated an independent Ukraine, and the Ukraine is one of the separatist republics in the Soviet Union at this time. After that, we took a look at information from Radio Free America 14 at the anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations and its activities attempting to destabilize the Soviet Union over the years. We took a look at an organization which was described in that broadcast as a pre-wackle-wackle, namely the Prometheus Group. The Prometheus Group, which involved, among other things, the pan-Turkist movement, something which was first founded as an independent, well, I shouldn't say independent, but which first flourished not only in Turkey, but also under the sponsorship of the Prometheus organization. It then collaborated with the Third Reich, and like the Galen organization with which it is involved, it jumped to the CIA and NATO at the end of World War II. The Prometheus organization collaborated with the Third Reich, and its major goal was not only to remove socialism and Marxism from the Soviet Union, but again to break the Soviet Union up into its constituent nationalist republics. We took a look also at the collaboration between the anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations and the Pan-Turkists, and also the collaboration between the OUN and the anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations. And specifically, we took a look at people like Theodor Oberländer, a key Galen functionary and SS man during World War II. It's his connection with the OUN and his connection with the anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations. And again, the review in Section 4 was from Radio Free America shows numbers 1 and 14. In the fifth section, the fifth installment of the broadcast, we took a look at the Free Congress Foundation once again, and we jumped from its activities inside the Soviet Union vis-a-vis Boris Yeltsin and the IRG. It's a Communist Party group set up by Yeltsin and Andrei Sakharov. We took a look at FCF activities inside of Eastern Europe, and in particular, we took a look at its connections with organizations that have served as repositories for residual fascist elements in Eastern Europe, and also as vehicles for the apparent resurgence of those very same fascist elements and anti-Semitic elements in Eastern Europe. Specifically, we took a look at the activities of FCF in connection with the Democratic Forum, or New Democratic Forum, in Hungary. That is an organization which has involved the active collaboration of residual members of the Arrow Cross organization, the Hungarian fascist organization with which Laszlo Pásztor, the aforementioned Laszlo Pásztor, was affiliated. We took a look at FCF activities in Romania and its connections with, among other things, the National Christians, the NCCP, I will find the exact title of that organization. I believe it's the National Christians Peasants Party, or NCPP, I guess it is. Yeah, National Christian Peasants Party, it's not NCCP, National Christians Peasants Party in Romania. That is an organization which had strong connections to FCF and which also has served as a repository for the Iron Guard, the brutal fascist organization which collaborated with the Nazis in World War II and which is showing signs of resurgence inside of Romania. We also reviewed the resurgence of anti-Semitism in that part of the world, and in particular, how organizations like the New Democratic Forum and the National Christian Peasants Party have served as vehicles for the resurgence of anti-Semitism in that part of the world. Among the things that we looked at in Week 5, in an article called Balkan Nationalists Peddling Fascism, we took a look at an organization called the Slovak World Congress in Czechoslovakia. Now, during World War II in Czechoslovakia, Slovakia was split up by the Nazis. The Nazis partitioned Czechoslovakia into its various component parts, and Slovakia was set up as an independent puppet fascist state under the Reverend Josef Tiso, named T-I-S-O. The main fascist collaborationist organization in Czechoslovakia during World War II was the Linka Party, spelled H-L-I-N-K-A, and the Slovak World Congress has served basically as a repository for residual Linka elements in particular as well, just like the New Democratic Forum has served as a vehicle for the Arrow Cross, and as the National Christian Peasants Party has served as a vehicle and repository for the Iron Guardists in Romania, the Slovak World Congress has served as a a vehicle for and repository for residual Linka Party elements in Czechoslovakia and around the world. The Linka Party, it should be noted, the Slovak World Congress was founded in and based in Canada, but there are strong connections between that organization and the government of Václav Havel in Czechoslovakia. The two main names, or three main names to know in connection with Slovak World Congress, are a fellow named Josef Kirschbaum and also a guy named Durkansky, and both of them were officials of the Linka Party and war criminals condemned in absentia for their collaboration with the Nazis. The founder of Slovak World Congress, a fellow named Steve Roman, R-O-M-A-N. It's worth noting that a fellow who was formerly director of Protestant broadcasting for Radio Free Europe, itself founded by Reinhard Galen, a fellow named Reverend Dusan Toth, T-O-T-H, has been appointed as a special foreign advisor to Václav Havel. It's also worth noting that just as Slovakia had achieved independence, quote-unquote, under the Nazis during World War II, the Slovaks, or many elements of them, are once again agitating under Václav Havel to break off from Czechoslovakia. And so we're seeing, to a certain extent, a recapitulation of the same historical patterns. We then took a look in Section 5 at activities going on inside Yugoslavia, and in particular we focused on the return of the brutal fascists, the Ustashi, or Ustashi-allied elements, in Yugoslavia and Croatia in particular. Yugoslavia has always represented a relatively fragile coalition of nationalities which had been formed at the end of World War I. During World War II, just as Slovakia was set up as an independent collaborationist state in Czechoslovakia by the Nazis, or what had formerly been Czechoslovakia, so Croatia was set up as an independent state inside of what had formerly been Yugoslavia. And we took a look at residual fascist elements, residual Ustashi elements operating under the auspices of not only U.S. intelligence, and a fellow named Omer Kanin, O-M-R-C-A-N-I-N. We also took a look at Ustashi elements operating under the auspices of the anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations as well. We took a look at attempts by Croatia to secede from Yugoslavia and the current possible fragmentation, certainly the enormous friction in Yugoslavia between Serbs and Croats. There is a very complicated ethnic situation inside of Yugoslavia, but we focus primarily on the Serbian and Croatian antagonism, and that is one of the main dynamics inside of Yugoslavia at the moment, which threatens to force the partition of Yugoslavia. It should be noted that we took a look at the statements by a residual Ustashi operating under the auspices of the anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations, a fellow named Bonifacic, I'm not sure how it's pronounced, B-O-N-I-F-A-C-I-C, and he stated in an address that he gave before an ABN meeting that it was the goal of the ABN to force the breakup of Yugoslavia. We also took a look in Section 5 at FCF activities and OUN-connected activities inside of the Ukraine and also Latvia as well. One of the major points to understand from Section 5 and one of the major dynamics to take a look at in our examination of the destabilization of the USSR in Eastern Europe are the fragmentary pressures, or the pressures to fragment some of the states of Eastern Europe into their various ethnic nationalities. There is renewed hostility in Romania between ethnic Hungarians and ethnic Romanians. There is obviously a renewed push for independence by the Slovaks in Czechoslovakia, and Slovakian independence was, and the partitioning of Czechoslovakia, rather, was actively put, it was done by the Nazis, just as we are seeing attempts by various nationalities inside the Soviet Union to secede from the Soviet Union. Many of the republics are attempting to secede. We are also looking at the attempted breakup, or the possible breakup, of Yugoslavia into its constituent republics as well. The anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations, again a key element of the former World Anti-Communist League and a major vehicle of both political inspiration and covert operation for the Reagan administration and the U.S. national security establishment in general, the goal of the ABN has long been the not only the rollback, quote-unquote, of communism from Eastern Europe, but the actual breakup of the Soviet Union into its constituent republics. It should be noted that we are now seeing in the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe an actualization of the ABN program to a considerable degree. It's also worth noting again that, as I said earlier, and as we noted in weeks past, as well as in the two-part Radio Free America series about the World Anti-Communist League, that the goal of the, that the anti-Bolshevik bloc of nations, I should say, had long been allied not only with the U.S. intelligence, but specifically represented a repository for Third Reich activists, people who had collaborated with the Third Reich or worked directly with the Third Reich, people like Theodor Oberländer, a key SS official. And it should be noted that the ABN was begun in 1943 in cooperation or collaboration with Adolf Hitler. What we are seeing to a considerable extent now in the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe is a rejuvenation of and fulfillment of Hitler's agenda, namely the partitioning of the various Eastern European countries, or some of them anyway, into their constituent republics, the perhaps incipient breakup of Yugoslavia. Certainly Yugoslavia is badly weakened. We're seeing renewed pressures to break up Czechoslovakia with the Slovakian independence movement gaining steam inside of Czechoslovakia. And again, in the Soviet Union, we are seeing renewed pressures by the various constituent republics to secede from the Soviet Union. It should be noted that, again, the Soviet National Security Establishment has stated in no uncertain terms that it will not stand for the partition of the USSR and for the breakup of the USSR. I don't know, perhaps they will change their mind and stand for that. My guess is they would no more stand for that than Abraham Lincoln stood for the breakup of the United States in the 1860s. It is my guess that if these nationalist and secessionist pressures continue, and it should be noted the active U.S. involvement with some of the most venal and openly fascistic elements involved in those nationalist movements, ultimately we will see a crackdown, perhaps a military coup in the Soviet Union, certainly a military crackdown. This will serve as a pretext for the starting up of the Cold War and a continuation of the high levels of military spending in the United States. That is a brief summary and a brief rundown of what we have looked at in previous installments. After a short musical break, we are now going to finish with the final installment of the destabilization of the USSR in Eastern Europe and take a look at what has happened as well as what figures to happen in the future. Music and then more information.